Mini episode 65 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.info.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, welcome to the FDH Lounge, specifically the fifth anniversary of the FDH Lounge. This is FDH Managing Partner Rick Morris coming at you. And we've got a very special guest lined up for the occasion. I first want to thank, as always, our good friend Russ Cohen of Sportsology for making this platform available to us. This has been tremendous for being able to have conversations with guests. And this conversation specifically with the guest is the centerpiece of our fifth anniversary celebration. We have some other conversations coming up this week with our panel of FDH Lounge dignitaries, but we've been looking forward to doing this segment here. I want to thank Russ and Sportsology for that. For our big occasions, we like to swing for the fences if we can with our guests. It is the show where nothing is off topic, so theoretically we should be able to handle just about any type of subject matter. And we got pretty lucky during the course of the fall to lead up to our 500th hour celebration with our fourth appearance on the program from Bob Barker, MMA and pro wrestling legend Ken Shamrock, and culminating it with Steve Perry. That actually kind of takes us to tonight, because we've had a number of great musical guests on the program over a period of time, but really only a handful of them that have had the commercial success of the gentleman that we're going to have on tonight. Steve Perry, certainly, Rick Springfield, John Oates. Ironically, they're also, I guess, contemporaries of this gentleman. They kind of came up at about the same point in time, but we've been really looking forward to doing this. He and his people were kind enough to send us out a couple of his CDs that we were able to get a chance to take a look at. His most recent one, I know we'll be talking about that one, Dr. Faith, also the Cafe Carlisle Sessions, which is kind of a nice smooth jazz kind of restyling of some of the hits that he is known for. It's a real pleasure to bring on the show five-time Grammy Award winner and somebody who has had some of the biggest monster hits, certainly, that are out there in existence, Christopher Cross. Christopher, welcome to the FDH Lounge, sir. It's a pleasure to have you on tonight.
Thanks so much. Nice to be with you.
It's great to have you on. I think a good place to start for this would be the lead-up, probably, to when you were able to get your solo career off the ground. And, of course, that first album, just an immediate smash success. What was the journey that kind of led up to that point there to getting that Warner Brothers contract and initially the first album out in 79?
Well, fairly unremarkable, I suppose, in terms of what most musicians go through. I played clubs and, you know, parties and bars and things to earn my living, kept myself going while I wrote and did demos and things like that. So pretty much like all musicians do, and they have their dreams, and I was fortunate enough to attract the attention of Warner's, then finally got signed in 78 and made the record and came out in 80.
That really was, again, just an immediate success those first couple of years. I know you had the eight top 40 hits and a number of songs within that. If you go to anywhere, the four corners of the globe to this day, and you hum a couple of bars, you'll probably put it in people's heads the rest of the day, and I suppose that'll be the case 100 years from now. So, you know, it was just a great period of breakout for you and really immediate success. And yet, you know, there have not been, over a period of time, any behind-the-music specials or anything like that. I mean, to the naked eye, you seem to be the rare individual who handled that kind of sudden fame and fortune pretty well.
Yeah, I was older. I was 30 years old at the time, so, you know, a lot of artists get discovered or have some success younger, and sometimes that can be problematic, but I'd been at it for a while, so I was a bit older and had a child, was married, so I'm hoping my feet were a little more on the ground.
Is that a thing? Do you think that was a pretty big key in that had it happened, say, at 20 or even, say, in your late teens, it might have been a different story? Or do you think you're just the kind of person that was fortunate enough to be able to handle it regardless?
Well, it's just really, it's hard to say. But, I mean, when you look at the tragedies like people like Amy Winehouse and things like that, I think that, you know, youth can play a part in that. So, you know, we'll never know. But I think that certainly, you know, being older and having a lot of that maybe the party years and stuff behind me and just being ready to, you know, work was certainly a part of it.
Yeah, that makes sense as far as how it would affect you or affect other people. In terms of the hits from that period of time, and this is a question more so about the structure of the music industry as opposed to any type of gauche finance question, but I think the average person would probably expect that with the mega hits that you had at the time there, that there would be probably to this day and probably for generations to come a steady stream of mailbox money attached to that, lingering royalties and everything like that. You think, is the average person basically clued into that? Is that basically an accurate representation of when you have songs that are that big, or is it something where that really it's not as glamorous as that, and the stream really does drop off after a period of time?
Sure, it does. I mean, the law of initial income is from sale of records, and so once people have your albums or CDs, whatever they have in their catalog, and all that stops because everybody has it. Certainly, you know, radio play and those kinds of things generate royalties, but of course, you know, as we all know, terrestrial radio is disappearing with the advent of all the digital technology and iPods and Pandora and that stuff, so all that stuff's compromised as well. There certainly will always be income from those sources, but it does dwindle, and with the new model, I think it affects everybody negatively.
That's true. That's true. With all the challenges the industry's gone through digital in the last 10 years or so, that's a very good point. As far as some of the big hits of that time period, I know that our senior producer Steve Cervillo, who was instrumental in getting you booked, as he's been great with doing with so many of our big guests. Specifically, he wanted me to ask you about this, and I think it's a great question on his part. Your thoughts when the metal band Saxon subsequently covered Ride Like the Wind. I think it was later in the decade of the 80s, and you yourself have gone on to do, as I mentioned before, and we'll talk about it a little bit more, a jazz reimagining of some of your tunes, but what was it like to hear somebody else do such a radically different take on it?
Well, it's always a compliment somebody covers your song. I've been fortunate to have some nice covers over the years, and, you know, they did a nice rock version of it. You know, more aggressive, and so, as I said, I've had lots of interesting covers from marching bands to the Saxon cover. Freddie Hubbard, great jazz musician, covered Ride Like the Wind as well, so there have been a lot of real interesting covers, and it's always a big compliment, you know, like I said, when somebody, you know, covers your tune.
Marching bands, actually, and I can remember back from my high school days, yeah, I mean, I would think that a couple of your hits would have lent themselves to that. Are there any particularly memorable ones that come to mind on your part, or do a lot of them just basically kind of blend together when you've heard them?
Well, I mean, you know, Chance of Ride Like the Wind, that was one that was very covered by marching bands. I think for a while it was the most covered marching band song. But, you know, I've been fortunate to have some hits and certainly songs that have, you know, got some legacy to them. So I'm very proud of that and I feel very fortunate. There's a lot of talented people who have, you know, remain undiscovered their whole lives and unrecognized so for their, you know, work. So, I feel very blessed for that, you know.
Oh, I can understand, certainly. And in terms of the legacy of that time period, I was struck by, I thought you were a very good sport about this, your appearance about two or three years ago on Fallon doing Ride Like the Wind, and then subsequently also Sailing when they were doing the whole Yacht Rock celebration there. That's one of those things that strikes me where the artists of the time period, you know, they can either take it in good humor and be glad that they're being exposed, you know, to another generation of people and people are getting a chance to see them. Or it strikes me it could go the other way, and so people could be, just go, are you making fun of me? Are you, you know, ripping on my music? So talk about that. What was involved with that, with going on the Fallon show and how you took it as this whole Yacht Rock thing gained popularity the last couple of years?
Well, you know, it has gotten to be kind of a cult thing, and Jimmy called me and just asked me, you know, about coming on the show with Mike and doing it, and I have immense respect for Jimmy. I've known him over the years, and he's a very classy guy, and I know he's a big, you know, 80s music fan. Of course, he has the roots on the show, and so I knew there would be a lot of intrinsic respect. He has a lot of, you know, more heritage artists on his show. For being a young host, he's very in tune with that kind of music, and I know really appreciates it. So I was never really concerned that there would be any sort of disrespect shown, because Jimmy is a big music fan and a lot of respect for those artists. So, and I was aware of the videos and the whole Yacht Rock thing. So, it was a lot of fun. Like I said, Jimmy's a very talented guy, good friend, and Mike, of course, and I have been friends forever. So we both enjoyed it, and you know, getting to play with the Roots, they're great, great musicians, and so it was a lot of fun.
Absolutely, and of course, as everybody knows, the Mike you're speaking of being Michael McDonald, he and Eric Johnson, two guys that obviously you've played a good amount with over the years, both showed up again on Dr. Faith. I have to tell you, as I was listening to it, I'm listening on there, I believe it was the title track. I hadn't looked at the liner notes yet to see who was on that. Oh, Michael McDonald, okay. So, you know, you've had a long and, you know, very fruitful association with both of those guys over the years, clearly.
Yeah, you know, both have been on a lot of the records, and at this point, they're old dear friends, and so I want them to be part of the projects, and you know, occasionally there's a signature part for Mike's voice that just, you know, obviously be great for him, as Dr. Faith was, and being a guitarist myself, Eric's a huge influence, and we grew up together, from teenage time, so the combination of their amazing talents, you know, lending that to the project, but also the long friendship, you know.
Oh, sure. That's got to be amazing to have them backing you, you know, with Michael McDonald with the Hall of Fame pipes, and Eric Johnson with his abilities that he has. We actually did a couple of years ago on the show, Christopher, we actually had a rock band draft on the show where instead of drafting fantasy football players, we were drafting musicians. I got Eric Johnson in my band, and I actually placed in second place for the way that the judges were scoring it there. And I have to credit his guitar playing as probably having swayed the judges to a great extent. What a talented guy. And you talked about being a little bit of a later breakout. He was even a later breakout than you were, but has gone along to have a nice solo career.
Yeah, Eric, you know, is kind of one of the great, undiscovered or, you know, diamond in the rough kind of things, you know, being in Austin. But he played on my first record on a track on Minstrel Gigolo, and that was really the first time he was really heard on kind of a major album release. And then, of course, subsequently went on to have a very deserved great career. He just released a new album himself, which is great. So, you know, we started out together in Texas playing in local bands and doing stuff together way back then, and remained very close. And, you know, he's in my mind, I think, you know, overall as a guitarist in terms of style and you know, technique and as an artist, you know, the greatest in the world. So, you know, it's great to see him get the recognition, you know, that he deserves for his work.
He is an incredible player, yes, no question about it. And you know, to get to have them both on that album, of course, again, Dr. Faith being your most recent CD released in 2011. And as I was listening to it there, it seemed like it was a mixture of a couple of different directions that you were taking. There was one or two songs in particular that sounded to me to be, at least vocally, kind of reflective of that peak period we were talking about before. And it just really kind of struck me that you can listen to Christopher Cross, I mean, even 30 years after that big breakout area. And the voice, it seems to me, has remained remarkably consistent. So what are the things that you've done over the period of time? Obviously, I mean, that's your moneymaker. You got to take care of it. But what are the things that you've done to be able to preserve it and to be able to sound the way that you used to sound?
Well, you know, I don't know. I don't smoke cigarettes and don't drink, so I suppose both those things are things that can affect and dry out your voice. And I just have always played, you know, continue to play live, which is in its own way of kind of rehearsing and practicing and keeping your voice in shape. And, of course, I always emulated and learned from, initially just as a fan and listener from Carl Wilson, my dear friend, rest his soul, from the Beach Boys. And then, of course, after I got to know Carl, so he was a big influence early on in my career, I said, just as a fan following his vocal style and then getting to know him later. So I think it's just, you know, a combination of emulating the best and then just, you know, continuing to do it all the time and taking care of your voice. Like I said, I think a lot of it's that. It's just, you know, trying to not sing when you're sick and just doing the usual things. But as I said, when you emulate someone, in my mind, you know, one of the great, great singers of all time, like Carl Wilson, then you kind of, you know, you start with some good ideas.
Absolutely, yeah, that's some tremendous inspiration right there. I want to ask you also, there was something that was on your Wikipedia page. I have learned the hard way in the course of this show not to take anything necessarily as gospel, although both times, coincidentally, in the course of doing the show or something was incorrect on somebody's page, It was a pro wrestler in both instances. So we have yet to have any musicians where there was any incorrect information on there. But I see on here, and I did not realize this, you mentioned about Carl Wilson, but participation with California Girls. Was that is that correct? You were one of the backing vocals on that?
Yeah, Carl and I did the Ross version, I presume you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah,
Carl, you know, Brian Wilson wasn't really doing much session work or, you know, at that point. And David wanted to have kind of a signature sound on his cover. And I think also, frankly, the stamp of approval from the boys. And Carl and I being very good friends, I did do a lot of vocal stuff with Carl during that period, you know, I guess, in, for lack of a better description, sort of subbing for Brian, if you will. So, you know, David asked me to do it and get Carl, and so we did. We did the background vocals for that, and it was fun. You know, obviously, anytime we have to sing with Carl, but it certainly, you know, again, put the stamp of legitimacy on David's track.
Absolutely. I can see where that would be the case to be able to do the song with him. Another thing on there on your Wikipedia page, and something that I suppose people really wouldn't associate you with, it also says that you had filled in one time for a concert for Ritchie Blackmore of Deep Purple in San Antonio. Is that correct as well?
Yeah, it was very early on, but before my success of my own with my album, this is back in the 70s. I was living in San Antonio, and they came through town. There was a first show in the States, and Ritchie was taken ill from a reaction to a flu shot, and they just didn't really want to cancel the show, and the promoter knew me and knew that I was a big fan of Ritchie's and just, you know, offered the idea of me just subbing for that one show just to kind of get him through the night. And I think it was a tough thing for the guys, but they sort of decided to do that, and so I was lucky enough to, you know, jump in and kind of cover that. I think it's something that they wouldn't remember and probably don't want to remember, but for me it was a big thrill. And then I did get to meet Richie at the airport when they did leave, when he was feeling better, and got a chance to, you know, talk to him for a second. So that was exciting. And interestingly enough, Eric Johnson at the time was in a group called Mariani, which featured a singer named Vince Mariani from Austin. Eric was a guitarist, and they opened the show. So we had played on a lot of co-bills together, Eric and I had, with his band at that point, Mariani. But they happened to be the opening act on that show.
Interesting. All right, so both of you guys were on the bill then, and that's a great story, just as far as being a real Walter Mitty moment for you, years ahead of, about a decade or so ahead of your own breakout. That's a great story. As far as, and we've talked a lot about thus far the breakthrough period that you had in the early to mid 80s here, your decision was very interesting to reimagine some of the songs as you were doing the Cafe Carlisle sessions. I was very entertained by checking that out. Talk about the thought process, if you would, on how that album came together and your approach to redoing some of the songs.
Well, there's a small cafe in New York at the Cafe Carlisle Hotel called the Cafe Carlisle, and I was asked to play there for a month in New York. It's an 80-seat room, very small, and I had to do it, you know, very stripped down just as a trio. And I wasn't really very, you know, excited about the process because I hadn't really done my songs in that kind of stripped-down presentation. But my girlfriend at the time was very encouraging, said, "Oh, you should do it. It'll be good for you to do something out of the your comfort zone." So I decided to do that and got two great, great musicians, David Mann, great, great sax player who is featured on Dr. Faith, and then Andy Ezrin, great, amazing pianist from New York, both, you know, serious jazz players. And we did it as a trio for a month, and it just kind of, you know, opened my ears to a different way of presenting the music. So then we decided, a good friend of mine, Chris Walden, great jazz musician and jazz producer, decided to, you know, make an album like that. We added some brush kit drums and upright bass and just did a treatment of the songs, you know, more unplugged, again, featuring, done pretty much in the same kind of arrangements, but just featuring the sensibility of using serious jazz players, not really smooth jazz players, but like serious jazz players. So they brought that sort of kind of sensibility and approach to the songs, but they're very much, I think, in keeping with the songs themselves, but it was just a lighter touch and, you know, more stripped down without all the synthesizers and electric guitars, and I enjoyed it very much, and we toured that album for a couple of years, and so it's nice now, because if I do have a cause to do a corporate gig or something where I need to play it as a trio or more stripped down, I'm comfortable in that ensemble.
Yeah, that was it was very recognizable, certainly, to people who remember the songs from back in the day. But as you said, yeah, just a little bit of tweaking here and there, and it was very interesting to get to hear a different, maybe a little bit more modern interpretation on them. Of course, artistically, you also, in the last couple of years, I believe it was 2007, put out A Christopher Cross Christmas, and doing the thing that many artists have chosen to do in recent years with tackling some Christmas songs. So how did you approach that kind of a project? What were your thoughts for the different types of Christmas songs you wanted to feature?
Yeah, well, the album actually, it comes out next year here in the States. It was released in Europe, did it in 2008. I've always wanted to do a Christmas album. I you know, I have favorites of mine from when I was a kid. And then my collaborator, Rob Muir, and I wrote two original Christmas songs. I did another song by a gentleman named Steve Dorff that I'd written with in the past. So I just kind of picked favorites, certainly Christmas song, a song from the movie White Christmas by Irving Berlin, Count Your Blessings. So I had, you know, some favorites from my childhood years, you know, A Little Drummer Boy and things like that I did my own arrangements on, and then did the two original songs. So I just tried to do an album that I've always loved, Nat Cole's Christmas, of course, Carpenter's. The albums that are kind of classic for me, the Charlie Brown Christmas and Scaraldi, that kind of held up every year. So I did the album very simple again, just piano, upright bass, and acoustic with strings, featuring Michael Amardian on piano, who produced my first four records, and tried to make something that was very classic in keeping with my style that would, you know, could really, you know, be seasonal and listen to every year, that you wouldn't, you know, where it wasn't kind of overly done. Like, you know, to me, a lot of people who do pop Christmas albums, sometimes they're too covered up with production. And I wanted to do something that was very simple and sincere, you know.
That is true. Yeah, there's a lot of them that do have that kind of overlayering with the production. It'll be interesting for the domestic audience to get to check yours out when it is released in the States. That is something clearly for your fans to look forward to. In terms of again, what the future holds for you, you've been in a pretty steady groove here with releasing albums over a period of time and touring. You mentioned just in passing here about some different corporate gigs here. So, what would you say the next year or so holds for you in terms of that? I know you've been playing. I think your website had indicated about an average of about 100 shows a year or so.
Yeah, I was just in Europe for a month. I'm going to Japan in March, so we go there once a year. I'm playing 70 to 80 dates a year. I just, you know, different things around the country and around the world. So I still tour consistently. I'm writing a lot. Rob and I are writing right now for another record. We've got about 16 songs in progress. There are different forms of being done. So we're certainly going to come with another record much sooner than is typical. There has been 12 years since Walking in Avalon 1998 to Dr. Faith this year. So this next album, I think you'll see probably in the next couple of years. So I'm in a very creative period right now with Rob, as far as writing, and going to make another record fairly soon. Otherwise, you know, it's just, it's like such as touring, which I enjoy very much more than ever, being getting older and realizing it's a sort of a finite thing. It'll end eventually. So I'm enjoying that. And then, like I said, in a kind of very creative space in terms of Rob and I writing, and I think we're looking to do another record, you know, I would say within, you know, release it in the next couple of years.
Interesting. Okay. Well, there's a little note of interest there for your fans that are catching this. We'll look for that in the next couple of years or so. Christopher, we always love to give our guests a chance to plug here. I know that you've got, among the things you're involved with, Steve Cervillo, our producer, our senior producer, had called to my attention, marathonkids.org. I know that you're involved with that, and I know that you said you've got your touring ongoing. So anything that we haven't hit sufficiently, please take it away.
Yeah, well, you've been very kind to mention. I mean, I think for me, there's always a lot of emphasis on the past work. You've been very kind to mention Dr. Faith, the new record, and, of course, the other project, Christmas and Carlisle. And, yeah, Marathon Kids is a great organization. They work with children 12 and under at risk for obesity. And, you know, my weight's something I've struggled with throughout my life. And I think it's something that we need to catch very early with kids to try to teach them to eat right and watch their weight. It's a huge problem in the U.S. So it's a wonderful charity because they basically have kids do a 26-mile marathon over the period of a year and, you know, watch what they eat and keep a journal and stuff. So it's a wonderful organization for people to check out and support. But, no, you've been very thorough. I appreciate the time. Like I said, it's always, you know, artists are always excited about their new work. It's kind of like the new kid in the household. So Dr. Faith certainly are what we're excited about right now in touring and very, you know, excited about the project. But you've kind of mentioned it. So it's been a pleasure, and I just encourage the fans to keep an eye on the website and see where we're playing, and you know, come out and hear the hits and what we're, you know, what we're doing now.
Well, Christopher, I've been glad to have this conversation with you here tonight. I really regard it as a mark of validation for our show, for our fifth anniversary, that we could have a good quality conversation with a gentleman such as yourself. I really appreciate it, and we'd love to have you back in sometime as things develop with you, Christopher.
Yeah, Rick, congratulations on all your success with the show, and like I said, it's just been a pleasure to talk to you. I'd love to do it again anytime.
That's great. I appreciate the conversation so much. Thank you very much, Christopher. I appreciate
your time
tonight.
Take care, Rick.
Appreciate it, sir.
Okay,
all right. Thank you very much. The great Christopher Cross, everybody. We appreciated having him on the program here today. And again, celebrating our fifth anniversary of the FDH Lounge.